Hi, this is Paul Ingham of PainScience.com, and I have a lisp today because I'm wearing a mouth guard. So we're going to start today's recording with a teachable moment about injury. I'm wearing a mouth guard because I have a tiny little bit of gum behind my two front teeth that has gotten swollen. I think it was irritated by a seed or some other, pokey bit of fibrous food. Maybe something got stuck under there for a little while. Maybe there's even something there now still because it is swollen. And so I cannot close my mouth without my lower teeth colliding with this swollen bit of gum, which really sucks. It keeps it irritated. There's an analogy that I've used many times over the years. I call it the biting your cheek analogy. Or when you bite your cheek, it gets swollen, then it gets very hard to stop biting, which is a bit of a vicious cycle. Well, it's exactly the same thing here, just with a slightly different piece of anatomy in my mouth. So I'm wearing the mouth guard because it is the only way that I can get any relief from this. This is a mouth guard I was given many years ago for teeth grinding, which I barely use because I really have trouble sleeping with it. But I break it out every now and then for something like this. And the teachable moment, very simple, is load management. And I'm managing the load on this tissue, just like it was a sports injury that I was giving a chance to heal. So far, every time I wear the mouth guard, I get about an hour of relief before it swells up again. And I have to start the cycle over. So far, resting, protecting it, hasn't worked for long. But since it is the one and only thing that seems to make a difference, I'm going to keep at it. I'm going to keep trying to give it as much of a break from stress as I possibly can. And hopefully that will do the trick. So there's a little bit of bonus content for you for this audio version, and I thought it would be funny, because it is, to read this post with a mouth guard powered lisp. So this is audio version of the post "Opioids Damned with Faint Insult," which is a title I may change yet. I'm not sure that I want to say opioids are damned in the title, even though if you parse that title, you realize that I'm saying that it weren't actually all that damned. But maybe I don't want to give the impression that opioids have been damned at all. Don't want to risk that misapprehension. As you'll see, this post is all about the damning of opioids and whether or not it should be happening. So skeptics love negative trials. It tickles our cynical biases to point to a big study in a fancy journal and say, see, insert object of our scorn, doesn't work. And when the OPAL trial of opioids for back pain was published by The Lancet last year, just about exactly a year ago, mid-2023, it inspired smug headlines like that. It was big bad news that opioids don't work for back pain. The truth is more complicated, and OPAL may not have told us enough for that kind of conclusion. Mere smugness is also probably the least of our worries here. More serious political motives may explain the celebration of this bad news like it was good news. We are in the midst of a hot war over opioid prescribing, with polarized interests and opinions, and patients stuck in the middle. So, OPAL in a nutshell, this was a 2023 Australian trial of a short course of slow-release opioids for subacute low back and neck pain of moderate severity. 300 people got either a placebo or an oxycodone-naloxone combo, plus standard care for up to 6 weeks. And there was no major difference in pain relief at the end of the test. The opioid group got more side effects, like constipation, of course. The paper concludes, quote, opioids should not be recommended for acute nonspecific low back or neck pain. Or as put by one of the authors a little more strongly on social media, Caitlin Jones, the OPAL trial findings provide strong evidence that opioids should not be prescribed to people with acute back and or neck pain. Is it really strong evidence for that, though? So the other side of the story, This was not a study of the opioids that you would get if you went to the ER with 10 out of 10 pain. So it seems odd that the OPAL authors concluded that opioids shouldn't be prescribed for quote-unquote acute pain, when what they actually studied was moderate subacute pain. This is just the first of many issues, and one of the only ones that's right there in the abstract. There are two whole categories of concern here. First, the science itself. There are legitimate concerns about OPAL's design, especially whether they studied the right drug for the right patients. And these concerns were ignored by The Lancet for a year before they finally published three response letters. And those response letters, by the way, are a very important source for this post. Basically, this post is summarizing, cribbing from the highlights of those letters. Second problem, category of concern, how the science was interpreted and presented, as if the results were much more broadly applicable than the evidence could actually support, even if they could be trusted, which they can't, see the first concern. Sorry, lost my place for a moment there. It's a lot to focus on with this mouth guard in my mouth. Find it distracting. You probably do, too. Sorry, I'm going to keep it going, though. I'm going to the courage of my convictions and read the whole thing with a mouth guard lisp. So the role of opioids in managing severe acute pain is not simple. They are a powerful tool with complex pros and cons, so probably a bad idea to demonize them based on one flawed study. What flaws? Highlights of the criticisms of OPAL. The paper's conclusion, quote, does not match nor reflect the trial's question, design, and scope. And that's from the first of the response letters by Weissman, Eubanks, and Masharawi. Given that Jones et al. Did not test what current guidelines actually recommend, it's strange, somewhat strange and galling that the authors seem to believe the clinical guidelines should be changed based on this one trial. Here are some of the issues related to this. Five bullet points. The study subjects had moderate subacute pain, not severe acute pain. The point of opioids in managing severe acute pain is just as much about the euphoria as its effect on nerve receptors, and to help patients right away, not to reduce pain weeks down the road, which is the only thing they measured. Only one type of slow-release opioid was tested, a drug that is already officially not recommended for acute pain because of its sluggish pharmacokinetics. So what exactly should be changed in guidelines that already tell doctors not to do this? Rather than adjusting the dosage to patient function, again, known best practice, quote, pain scores of 0 to 1 were targeted, which might not be considered judicious use, close quote. Understatement by Waba and McIntyre, one of the three letters. The study seemed to be based on the dubious premise that the goal of opioids for acute pain is to stop future pain, because pain relief wasn't measured when it was most acute. Oh, hey, I'm repeating myself here. I don't need this bullet point as well as the earlier one. Okay, there's an edit to do later. Anyway, it's worth repeating. So pain relief wasn't measured when it was most acute. It was measured many weeks later. What do pain levels several weeks into an episode have to do with what physicians do with opioids in the ER? Okay, done repeating that point. Last point, other pain medications aren't without their own limitations and risks and sometimes can't be used at all. For instance, you can't give NSAIDs to someone who's had a recent gut surgery. And so blanket statements, blanket interpretive conclusions like opioids should not be prescribed are an obvious oversimplification. Wahaba and McIntyre again, quote, this study can only conclude that modified-release opioids used for the management of subacute low back pain with or without neuropathic pain were no better than placebo. No change to current guidelines can be based on this conclusion. Unfortunately, we're not done talking about the flaws. OPAL can't be trusted to tell us anything even within its scope. A few more bullet points. The results had low some words are harder to say with the mouth guard than others. Statistical The results had low statistical significance. Ooh, I'm going to avoid saying that again, but it's in the next sentence. Low statistical significance, although very close to the traditional threshold for statistical significance, this result is on the wrong side of it. And while somewhat arbitrary, that line is drawn there for a reason. That reason being, let me elaborate on that a little bit. So it is an arbitrary line. P equals 0.05 is considered the threshold for statistical significance. If it gets below that, you're into significance. If it's above that, you're into insignificance. Obviously, it's a spectrum. But the point is that as you approach, let's say the number is getting higher and higher, on your results, it's getting closer and closer to insignificance. But by the time you get to 0.05, you're already pushing your luck. You're already at a point where it's like, well, this isn't super duper statistically significant. If you pass it, then you're definitely there. So, you know, even at 0.04, you kind of look sideways at it. You're like, well, it's pushing statistical insignificance. But by the time you hit the actual agreed upon conventional threshold, it's like, yeah, that's not statistically significant anymore. That's the whole point of it. That's the point of the line, the point of the threshold. So, such a result cannot inspire confidence even if there were no other problems. We wouldn't take a positive trial of a drug seriously if the results weren't statistically significant. So why should we take a negative result seriously if it's not statistically significant? Whew! I'm done saying statistically significant. The study mixed specific spine pathology with undiagnosed back pain, which is problematic. That was a quick point. Next point. Neuropathic pain is less opioid responsive, but was not excluded from the study. If you test opioids on patients known to get less benefit from opioids, then you're going to see less benefit. Non-pharmacological interventions were not standardized or recorded, so there's some potential confusion there. Almost a quarter of people in the placebo group used non-tested opioids independently, a potential confounder. And finally, the briefest point of all, there was a high dropout rate, which you don't love to see. Now, every study can be nitpicked, as I've discussed, you know, constantly in my work, and no one study can ever tell the whole story. But some of those flaws, particularly the statistical significance, it's in deal-breaker territory. Yoda et al., I think that's the third of the response letters to the Lancet, quote, considering these points, the results could be underpowered. We should be careful when drawing decisive conclusions based on this trial. Indeed. So now, to wrap this up, about the aftermath, the narrative, and casting critics as trolls on social media, many patients worldwide have been hurt by opioid phobia. Reaching beyond dubious data to demonize opioids is serious. Weissman, Eubanks, and Masharawi, quote, we are afraid that in its current form, the paper and its conclusion are a disservice to patients needing opioids and to practicing clinicians and could contribute to promoting anti-opioid agendas, demonization, phobia, and further unwarranted policies. The OPAL authors dismissed most or all of these criticisms and blocked and even name-called critics who expressed these concerns on social media. For instance, Dr. Chris Marr, probably the most famous of the OPAL authors, wrote on X Twitter, I'm hoping that the armchair critics get in the trenches and do some research rather than sit on the sidelines and create noise. I suspect I will be waiting a long time. I don't think we should let a small bunch of research Karens hijack the narrative for their amusement. He's referring to critics who do indeed do some research, and definitely do not just sit on the sidelines. I am fairly appalled by that response, and characterizing concerns, legitimate criticisms, published in The Lancet as amusing. I think that's characterizing those kinds of concerns and criticisms as amusement is pretty incredible. I lost track at the beginning of that sentence. I hope it made sense by the end. Replying elsewhere, Dr. Marr writes, I've blocked several people to hopefully create a Twitter subworld that is enjoyable to participate in. Let the others live in the sewer of their own making. So again, this is an author of the Opal Trial responding to very earnest, serious criticism. I think that's a noteworthy degree of contempt shown for earnest criticism from professionals. Criticisms that were published in a major medical journal. So yeah, problematic attitude in response. Better late than never? Not much better. The publication of the critical letters in The Lancet was definitely late, but was it better late than never? I think it's much too late in terms of public relations damage, which is the only kind of damage that I think matters in this situation. Almost all of the demonizing damage it could possibly have done has already been done, and most of it cannot be undone. How differently might this have all gone if the abstract's conclusion didn't reach so far beyond the evidence? If the author's public comments about it hadn't been so sweeping? Without the overreach, we would merely have a study of limited and specific value, a puzzle piece study. But it wouldn't be a huge public relations problem for the medical utility of opioids. So, Opal studied the wrong thing for the wrong people at the wrong times with statistically insignificant results. And then the authors rode a wave of media hype and made bold public statements about opioids that reached past what their evidence could support. And the result of all that was like pouring gasoline on the fire of opioid phobia. Last word to Dr. Jim Eubanks via private correspondence. Jim wrote to me, "There are differences between our use of opioids for acute pain versus chronic. I think everyone who is in academic medicine at this point appreciates chronic opioids are not a viable long-term option for most. But as opioids remain critical to the management of acute pain and are cheap and generally available, I am frustrated that the Opal team left nuance out of their initial discussion," end quote. And I would add and conclude that they left out of most of the discussion in the aftermath, too. Whew. It feels like it took a lot of energy to read that with the mouth guard. If it was like fingernails on a chalkboard for you, I sincerely apologize. But I personally will always remember this reading and enjoy and laugh at the memory. Talk to you next time, hopefully without a mouth guard and a lisp.